Accession number 30024.
Bill Bushell, reel 3.
Okay. And then, just for a very brief moment, three of us were posted to Ramsgate. What an awful billet. We won't go into detail. There we were posted then.
Why just the three of you?
That's the way you got split up in postings. I can't answer for that. It was just different units that sort of... I'll be quite honest, I don't know quite how that works. You just took it for granted, you know. I mean, three of us were posted to Ramsgate in this awful billet.
What was wrong with Ramsgate?
Well, it was a sort of a make-do-and-men billet, I think. We had to get washed and dressed in the kitchen of the house while the woman of the house was making our breakfast sort of style. The chap, I don't know quite what he had, talk about Brits on the side, you never knew what was going and coming. It was an awful place. And all we had was the same meat paste sandwiches for tea every... Fortunately, we were only there from the 4th of March to the 27th of March. That's 3 weeks. Then we were posted to Parkstone Pool. And there, we were... again, a couple of months there, we're getting made up with vehicles, etc., etc., because Parkston Park, was our vehicle lager, or park, if you like. And there, I got stung because they were allowed 48 hours for embarkation leave before we moved to Southampton. And yours truly was put on skeleton staff. So I didn't get any 48 hours leave. I was... it sounds awful, I don't even know this, like reciting this, but I actually coached a staff sergeant who became in charge, the HQ office eventually. I didn't want to leave my petrol section. I was sort of getting involved. And then, of course, we moved from there to Southampton. And we're in Canvas, just on the outskirts of Southampton. And then we were only there a couple of days, 13th to the 16th, 3 days, when we sailed to France. And that was an Isle of Man boat Manx made.
Just pausing there.
Which I'd been on previously, on a holiday to the Isle of Man. Because my wife and I, in our courting days, we loved the Isle of Man. It was a lovely island. We'd been there many times. And we had anticipated retiring there, but things didn't work out quite the same. But, and I've been across on the Manx Maid more than once. And, of course, when we eventually came out of France... We came back on the Tynwald, which we'd always sailed on, because the Tynwald and the... I only mentioned it to my carer. Snaefell. The Snaefell and the Tynwald are the two lightest boats of the Isle of Man fleet. And my golly, did they get knocked around if you were... full recording, still.
Before we come on to the France campaign, how did you find full-time army life? How did you adapt to the...
Well, like to say, where there's no sense, there's no feeling. I accepted it quite well. I'd already learned discipline in this. I always maintain I learned discipline first of all in my school, because discipline then was a different story. And as an aside, if there was any rough stuff or bullying while I was in the boys' school, the prefect would report you to a master. The master would take you upstairs, where our gym was, actually, upstairs. and you'd be given a pair of boxing gloves. Now, set two. And whether he could half kill you or not, you had to stand up, have a good, you know, really good thumping.
From the master.
And no, two of you, the two boys, you see, that were causing trouble. All right, then, that's enough. Now shake hands.
Oh, sorry.
No more. That's right. Yes, sir. Right, sure. No messing. A friendly clip over the head, didn't it? Anyway, apart from that, and I maintained my discipline was also in the gymnasium. And, of course, in the TA. So when I came to Liverpool, I was in an advantageous position in relation to the other young chaps or the other men that had come with me, you see. So there we go.
Could you talk a bit more about the weapons training?
It was apart from rifle and drill. We did have a go up on the firing range at Bisley. Where, I don't know where we were at. Oh, we must have been at Morley Camp. Oh, sorry. I don't know. We went up on a firing range, and that's where we learned to use a rifle. And yours truly again became 20th out of 300 for marksmanship. The warrant officer at that time, who eventually got the sack, but the warrant officer at that time thought he was the bee's knee. But and yours truly pipped him. So, there we go. That's another story.
How did they go about teaching the rifle use?
Well,
aiming and so forth.
Oh, they were quite in a safe manner. You would you had your weapon. Had to sort of, you were taught it how to clean it and one thing and another, and you would drill with it. And then when you settled down, you either leant or kneed down. You knelt down sometimes. You aimed standing up, which was very rare, unless you had something you were falling over the top of something. Namely, you were snuggled down into the ground. And they get you used to that. And then when you're on the range, you were in. Well, then you only did what you were told then. Load. Well, you'd already been checked on your five rounds in your 303 rifle at that time. And you showed that. Okay. Load that. You know, put your breech in. And then. Okay. You're going to fire. You see your targets up there. You see, so much. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all right then. Load. All right then. Put in. First pressure. Because it had like a little on the trigger. Right, your aim. Fire. You see. Yeah. And that's how you got. And you had more than one go. You used to have. Application, grouping. Application was correcting every shot onto the bull if you were lucky, and then grouping. Whichever your first round went in, you try and get all your other four rounds, because you should have five rounds, you see. On that grouping, you see. If you had a 2.5 group, you were good. Then you had rapid, which was you just one after the other, your whole fire magazine fire, trying to keep it on the bull or whatever you, well, on the bull then. And snap was the target used to come up and go down, and you had to take snap shooting, see, and that was it. You had the other thing, and when out in the, we'd go out in our minute, like before. We didn't see, we did, apart from anything else, going into France, we did more training really after we'd been to France. While we were in Surrey and devices, because then we really got our yomping boots on then, and then we'd crawl across the open ground and hide behind blades of grass and things like that, you see. Mm-hmm. Then we, where was the gas chambers? Went through gas chambers for gas mask training. Where was that? I can't remember that. But it was all part and parcel while we were in Britain, before we went out. Actually, we were really working company, because while we were doing all that, our vehicles were also going out on detail, keeping the armoured units, which were still in that, like, we were all in a big area, large area, they were still going out, supplying them with petrol, you see. Well, my section was, isn't it? And then, of course, the suppliers, they'd be keeping rations up. Ammo, they're not so much, because they weren't using any, unless they were on some training bent of live ammunition, that's all. Yes. So,
what was it that made the difference between a good marksman and a bad one?
Oh dear. I mean, I mean, I've always worn glasses. And we have sharp sights in a way. I think really, it's all according to some chaps. They weren't as tall on out and papers. Oh yes, they were lattos. But when it comes down to things like that, they're a bit doubtful, you know. Perhaps apprehensive, perhaps is the word. I don't know. I just got down. I was going to enjoy myself. that's all I can. And it was my father that told me about keep good pressure into your shoulder. And that helps a lot, because it's got a bit of recoil. And if you don't really hold it in, the crook of your shoulder, you know, when you fire. And it also helps to take aim. And over 100 yards, you generally... different now, because your sighting is different. You've got telescopic sights and all that lot, but these were just the open sights with your raised back sight for the distance, you see. Well, if you're about 100 yards, you'd aim for 6 o'clock, because in that distance you just get that little bit of rise. And I mean, all being well, the wind and things like that, you see. So all that comes into the situation. But the rank and file, they don't tell you all about that. But you've got to have a little bit of, like, a few tips here and there. And that's all I can tell you there. 200 yards, yes. You've got a 6-foot target, how he looks at them. But, that's all I can tell you, really. It's up to the person himself, really. I just admire them. Mm-hmm. I mean, a Bren gun. As an aside, I was records of things weren't quite the same when you're moving like that. And I had a spare job of the boys' anti-tank rifle in France. Well, that thing was obsolete before it was really used, because it killed the inventor. It had about a 2-foot recoil over and above the oil pressure recoil built in the weapon. And it had a 5.5 round, a bolt action just like a 303, you see, but it was a 5.5 round. And it just took your eardrums off if you fired it, and it would report. But it also pushed you back a couple of feet, and you had to make sure you had nothing behind you. You had nothing like, you know, it was a footrest or anything like that. You know, if it did push you, you know, it would push you. But I didn't have to fire it in anger, only in practice in here. In France, I had it, and it came out with me, but then that was handed over for the weaponry that was on the top deck. Bren guns. They were taken off and used on the top deck for those that were on the top deck. And that was all. It was interesting to know about it, but I never had to use it in reality. I was one point. I was camouflaged from the road, and the most it would do, you might be lucky to hit to go for the track of the tank. You see, go for the track, because otherwise it wouldn't. It's supposed to be armour piercing, but just bounce off. And the thing was, you're not camouflaged from the air, and this particular is just getting nearly knocking off time, put it that way. I was about a quarter of a mile away from the vehicle lager, well, purposely, of course, because even under the report, they'd hear it. It didn't know about me. Anyway, the thing was that these two hind claws came out of the sun, because the sun was low. And first one, he came low enough, because they into 40, they had their own way. There was no opposition with our Air Force then, at that time. And I saw him go like that, see. And then, next minute, the other one came around and brrr. Of course, I was digging a hole in the bottom of the ditch. And it took chippings out the tarmac road, and like missed me by miles, frankly. But it hit the duck pond on the outskirts of where our vehicles were. And we only assumed they were after a French anti-aircraft crew that had downed a German bomber early in the day. And that's all we knew about it. Then it vanished. For me, I was able to breathe again. But that was only a one-off episode. But and whether they realised there was no opposition, they just buzzed off, or what? Or they were still looking for the French anti-aircraft unit, you see. And we made sure at times they weren't near us, because, I mean, each vehicle was loaded with 3 tonne of petrol, and when they go up, they go up. But there we go. That was an instant. Oh, all asides, unfortunately.
Was it, you said it was Parkstone that you first had the vehicle training?
Yeah.
What were you using?
Well, actually, 3 ton Benfords. Remember, we were all volunteers, so we were all drivers. I'll be honest, I wasn't at that time, but needs must, and one thing and another. And it wasn't long before I was buzzing around. And then, of course, if I had more than one of us, we were all checked then that you were capable, you see, of driving a vehicle. And that's how I gained my driving license, because I came out with it and got... of course, that was years ago. It may not work nowadays, but that's how it was. It wasn't my particular job as a driver, although I did quite a bit of driving, actually. And because at one time I had my own, like, I had my my vehicle was my office really at one time, but I got shifted around time and time again because although my section was the petrol and oil section, I got put back into supplies, so I could do those as well. I could do that sort of work as well, like for what was necessary. Wing supply, back to petrol. And when I was moving up the desert, I had a French leave into my own old unit, but I was on supplies at the time, and I got hooked back. And lucky, you know, you don't play fast and loose like that. But nonetheless, that was when you were young and foolish. You couldn't care to care, you know, couldn't care, and still.
What were the Bedfords like to drive?
Not bad. They were... actually, the one I liked was the Thornycroft Sturdy, but they didn't... Our Bedfords went to France with us. Well, then we were... Then when we came out, we were refitted with... something, and Thornycroft Sturdies, honestly. The Thornycroft Sturdy was a horrible, straight windscreen and bonnet, like sort of style, all in one, like one down. Very cumbersome. And you could sort of go one, two, three. Everything was double D clutch in those days, of course, there's no synchro. And a lot of us had to have something under our heel for the accelerator, because it was the way you square. It was a great big square cab, and your gear lever there, and you could sort of... And the revs were so slow. You know, like that second, you know, the third. But although that was classed as a three-tonner, that would go up the side of a wall with 7 ton on it, crossing it. Now, the commas, I can't say in Tommy language. They were all so-and-so and wind. That's what we thought of them. Yes, they were stylish. But they had no guts in them, you know, like, you know, they just barely take the 3 ton and that was it. But the Thornycroft Sturdy, it took ages to rev up. But they go on literally, you know, forever and ever. And you could load them up and no trouble. And then, but then of course, when we went to North Africa, we lost all those, and we were fitted out with Chevrolet, all mass-produced steel-bodied Chevrolets, and they weren't bad vehicles. We went right up until, well, where I was concerned, we went right up to capture, a period of capture, and there was only one incident. When I was concerned, and I think a water tanker was the other one, but that had no, like, we weren't concerned with that. But one of our vehicles had its, we went across these what we call thermos bombs. I don't know what the real name were, the real name was, but Jerry used to just throw them out where there was this sort of horrible lumpy grass tufts of. He'd still in it, and he could run into them, and this one took a wheel off, and fortunately it didn't penetrate up into the driver's cab. I went to get out because I was the following vehicle at the time, and I was driving instead of the driver, and I went to step out under my there was one right under my foot. I just missed my wheel had just missed one by the thickness of the tyre sort of style. And anyway, we had to just gingerly clear and then pop them off as best we could. And we called them, because they were just like a thermos flask. Like, you know, didn't you? Yes. And they were just like something you had to watch out for. Well, I mean, then of course there was mines. They were a different kettle of fish. But... yeah, to drive through convoy, to drive through a minefield, you had men standing down, direct, like hold it, you know, keeping, because you didn't have much to play with over here with your vehicle, especially if you touch it, just a bit of soft sense, you know, you could feel your vehicle just sway a bit. Yes, and all part of the interest of going up the desert.
You mentioned that you'd been interested in the ships.
Yes,
when
yes.
You were in Liverpool. Had you given any thought to joining the Navy?
Yes. That was my first thought. And thickhead, I nearly got put into the and brig. The recruiting officer was an old-timer CPO. You know, he had crossed anchors and goodness knows what all over him. And he says, yes, laddie. Of course, I stood to attention very smartly. I said, I wish to join the Royal Navy, sir. Ah, yes, he said. I said, yes, I wish to join as a writer, sir. Because that was... He didn't let me wear a monkey suit. And I said, yes. I said, yes, age 18 to 23 years, sir. That's right, yes, laddie. And so. He says, how old are did you say? I said, 23 years, sir. He says, when? I said, June, you see. And he said, you're in your 24th year. Could he get that into my thick head? At that time, I just, you know, single-mindedness sort of style, thick head. Well, it made sense, you see. Once you reach 23, you really are in the 24th year. Maybe 11 months to go, but you... Well, I couldn't get me. I was so disappointed. I could join as a stoke, you know, any old way. No. Sorry, sir. I'm awfully sorry, sir. I'm sorry I made a mistake and all that, like, you know. Laddie, he says, could try, you know, sort of survive, like a... as a deckhand going through the job centre. And I said, well, yes, I'll think about it. So if anyone can get up. Oh, dear, and that was my... And to go as a merchant navy now. I mean, I knew what merchant navy life was, really, you know, in my knowledge of shipping and all that lot, you know. And then again... one of my bosom pals in captivity, Bill Beckerstaff, who was also a Liverpudlian, he had been seafaring. And merchant life. No.
So you were too old?
I wasn't too old, no. I joined the merchant.
For the Royal Navy, I mean.
I wasn't, no. It was because I was just, 23 years and... Well, it'd be about 3-4 months, you see. And it's just that I'd set on the work. I didn't savvy being anything else. At that time, you see, there's life, you know, you have different thoughts going through my mind, you know. I mean, I made a mess of my TA. I could have gone back in the second line. That's the first mess I made up of. And I thought, oh, gosh, you go back. Oh, yeah, reform the second line. Oh, I miss all my pals. And I was a bombardier then, you see, in the NTA. I know, I miss all my pals. I'm looking at. It was all my pals that formed the second line, because junior NCOs and whatnot, they were transferred into a second line, you see. And it was only when I met my old quartermaster sergeant, Blanco White. And in town, he says, hey, he says, what are you doing? You know, why aren't you sort of... I said, no, and I explained everything to you, you see. And that's how I knew, you know. And now he says, oh, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. You know, they... Oh, God, that is... You see? But he was too old. He'd been in the First World War, you see, and he'd served his time, and that was it. But I met him, Blanco White, because I used to work with him, you see. In fact, I used to help him with decimals on Russian things. But there we go.